So I'm doing this session series on eco-reformation, and I spent a lot of time talking on Wednesday about the reason for this book that I've co-edited, and I shared some theological perspectives from four of the 16 contributors. Today I'm going to focus on this title, Rewilding Christian Spirituality, and I'm going to lift up two of the folks out of this book, and then on Friday I'm just going to talk about one person out of the book, me, my contribution to the volume. So let's just get started here, and this one's going to be a lot more dialogical, so we have three opportunities for kind of focused discussion. Some of you may have read an article in the Lutheran, and this image may be reminding you of it. It was an article by Ben Stewart, who is one of our two guides. These are the two people whose essays that I'm doing my best today to bring together and to share with you. I'm sorry that Lisa's picture is a little fuzzy. It was all I could snag off the internet up here at Holden. I'm not sure I got the best resolution. Ben is actually on the board of directors here at Holden. Most of our session is going to focus on the biblical motif of water, flowing water. The flowing waters of eco-reformation is the subtitle of this session. But I want to begin with the motif of light. And I was sitting at breakfast this morning. I don't know if any of you were there when they did announcements, and then it's called the first word. Instead of mountains, and this was what was prayed this morning. With the rising of the sun, let us seek to know God, whose coming is as sure as dawn, whose grace is like rain, renewing the face of the earth. And I thought, man, if there's ever a day that I'm supposed to teach this session, this is it. You got both motifs in one very brief prayer. So just beginning, first of all, with the sun as a motif. Religious orders in the history of Christianity, would get up at the crack of dawn, face the sunrise, and pray the Benedictus. This is one of the most famous passages one of my favorite lines. The dawn from on high shall break upon us to shine on those who dwell in darkness and the shadow of death, and to guide our feet into the way of peace. Thousands of Christians woke up every morning and prayed the Benedictus. In addition, these are Ben Stewart's insights. He also emphasizes that church worship was, I love this term, phototrophic, that church buildings and graves were oriented to face the rising sun, that on the day of your resurrection, the sun would shine on you and you would rise from the grave. Do any of you know, those of you that have home congregations, whether your churches, whether the congregants facing the altar are facing east?
Yes.
Okay, and apparently by intention? Not sure. Or maybe by accident?
I don't know.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. It is a case in our church. No, we face north. We're dreary Norwegians. And then one of the earliest Christian theologians, Origen, this is one of his lines, that natural is to be set before the artificial. His point here was, rather than focusing on a book of prayers that religious orders should memorize, instead better to get out of the cloister or get where the sun can strike you, and to allow the natural to become the norm rather than the artificial. By the time we get to the medieval era, however, the Christian focus on light during the Gothic medieval era shifts our eyes towards heaven. I love this picture, and the reason I like it is because you can kind of see a ladder, right, in those rays. You can understand why someone might be attracted toward the heavens, because after all, isn't that where God is, the creator of the heavens and the earth? And so here, during the medieval era, we actually return to a form of religiosity that was pretty common even in the days of Jesus, namely Gnosticism. This suspicion of the material world and a desire to associate with the infinite rather than the finite, the ethereal rather than the physical, to shed the body and to rise toward the light. So the point here, Paul Santmaier, I don't know if any of you know that name, but Santmaier is an important historical theologian in the Lutheran Church. He was one of the primary authors of the ELCA Social Statement on Caring for Creation. He emphasizes that this medieval Gothic era strongly emphasized ascent. And I suppose, you know, the reality is in the medieval era, people didn't live anywhere near as long as we live today. They didn't have modern dental care. They had serious malnutrition or dietary deficiencies. And so life wasn't always so wonderful here on earth. And you might understand why someone might look towards the heavens. But Santmaier argues that Luther changed that trajectory from ascent back to descent. And this is one of the slides I used the other day to try to intersperse my remarks by emphasizing or showing you how Luther's theology was very creation-centered. The power of God is present at all places, even in the tiniest tree leaf. Do you think God is sleeping on a pillow in heaven? God is wholly present in all of creation, in every corner behind you and before you. So Ben, in his essay, emphasizes that God's goodness is continually overflowing into God's creation, that God's grace is poured out for the redemption of the world, and that like gravity, it is persistent. I don't know about you, but I can only defy gravity for a moment. Then I rise back to earth. This is in a large measure what Ben is trying to say that Luther is doing, is pushing that trajectory back down, regrounding Christian theology and spirituality, that the movement of salvation is not away from the earth, but toward it. Two of the important biblical texts, and I'm shifting away from light towards water, are the passage from, this famous passage from Amos, let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream, and that God sends rain on both the righteous and the unrighteous. In the rest of the session, I'm going to focus on the biblical motifs of springs, the floods, and springs, and then also talk a little bit about the sacrament of, we are going to talk about the sacrament of baptism, and whether we should move it outdoors. But before we get to that, I'd like you and, you know, either folks that you feel comfortable visiting with next to you, or if you want to be brave and get up and go talk to somebody else, I'd like you just to talk about these things for a moment. What are your strongest memories of streams, floods, springs? Have you ever paused by a stream? I hope you have here at Railroad Creek to listen to it as it ripples or cascades by. Have you stood at the edge of a flooding river? Have you ever drunk from a spring in the wilderness? And why are these memories important to you, and do they have anything to do with your faith? So take a few moments and maybe think about those things for a moment, and then when you're ready, turn around and find someone to visit with and share those experiences, and then we'll come back together. I've got a couple things I want to kind of throw into the hopper, and then we'll use that as grist for the mill as we go forward. Take another minute. Well, good. Let's start with the stream question. Did anybody share a story about a memory associated with a stream? Yeah.
I did, because we were up here when we had a baptism in Railroad Creek.
Wow. How long ago was that?
Probably 10 years ago.
Okay.
And we all marched down there with a banner. Yeah. Of course.
And this was in January.
No.
during the summer?
Yeah.
And did the person come out blue?
No, he was a baby.
Oh, my. Wow. So probably not immersion, probably just reaching down into the water. But.
I think they actually put him.
Say again?
I think they actually put him
okay.
in.
Okay. Okay, that's...
His mother was
I did not plant this woman in the audience. Thank you. We'll come back. Well, can you say a little bit more about why you remember that and why that was why that has stuck in your mind for so long?
Because it was so different from what I've grown up with.
Mm-hmm.
I've grown up with not immersion, sprinkling. And this was very, very nice.
Yeah, okay. Well,
especially nice because we all marched down there.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk more about that in much more detail in just a moment. Any other stories about streams that were shared?
Just hiking today at Lake Holden and the echo of the streams as you go up and come back. And it's just going around a corner, hearing it makes me happy.
Yeah.
I just feel this happiness about life is moving, continuing to move in a way that nature is created this opportunity for us to be here. Water is pure, it's pure as it can be today.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this famous line from Amos, "Let water roll down like waters." That, I mean, that's really evoking the image of a waterfall. And then righteousness, let justice roll down like waters, and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. And I agree with you when you have that sound. It's calming for me anyway, and it's like a sound that is the way things should be, and it's interesting to me that Amos puts he associates righteousness with that. I don't count myself as one of those people, but I know some people who I think manifest righteousness in that sort of steady, constant, flowing way, and. I guess I strive to be that, you know, like that, but I think I'm a little too mercurial at times to capture that. Any other stories about streams?
Well, being on a backpacking trip even, to hear a river flowing or a stream flowing, you know, that's like, okay, that's my next water source.
Yeah.
I'm going to survive by this, and I know a break is coming, so.
Yeah. Yeah, the source of life. Yeah. Without water, we perish in how long?
3 days.
3 days. So vital. What percentage of our bodies are made up of water?
97, 98%.
I brought this rock with me today. My first time at Holden Village was in January of 1979. Karen was a student at Pacific Lutheran University, and I was a sophomore, you were a first-year student. And we were both taking a course on the nature of creativity, and it was jointly taught by faculty from California Lutheran and Pacific Lutheran and another school, Augustana maybe? Or was it just those two? We were sitting in this very room, and about where you are sitting, a young man by the name of Paul Ringo, who I have not kept touch with after graduation, made a point that I'll never forget, and it's seared in my memory. And I don't know why, maybe the instructors had asked us to bring a physical object to class and to explain why it was significant to us, but Paul Ringo brought a stone similar to this. You know, you can see the hard, jagged edges on this fireplace. This is, you know, you can see where it probably had harder edges, right? But now those edges are rounded. And Paul said, for him, this was a symbol of God's grace, that over the course of our lives, grace knocks off the rough edges. I've never forgotten that. What was that?
That's a wonderful thought.
And Paul had struggles with mental health, but man, was he an insightful guy. So anyway, that's my story about streams. I bet there were stories about floods. Yes? Who has a story about floods?
Well, not exactly floods, but we have a boat on the Everett waterfront. And one day we decided to use the dinghy and just go across the Sonoma River. And the tide was going in, it started going in, so it was like a flood tide. We got across, floated down to the dock that takes you over to the peninsula where the beach is there and rowed back across. But then we could not row against the tide at all.
Because the raging river, the swift current. Anybody else share a story about a flood event or a fast-moving river? Karen and I are... Go ahead.
Oh, I didn't share this with Barb because it just not came to my mind, but I just remember one time Eric and I, my husband, and I think our kids weren't born yet. We were in Northern California, and we were on this road trip, and so we stopped at a river that looked... You know, it was pretty deep. He'd swam there before, but I never had.
Mm-hmm.
And it looked fairly quick. But he said, you know, it's not a problem. You can make it across. And so he swam across. It didn't look like a problem for him. But I when I jumped in, I was okay on the edge. But as I got toward the center, I could not believe the strength with which that current was pulling me. And I was pretty scared, and I made it across, but not without beginning to feel quite panicked.
Yeah.
So just with how fast and strong it was when it didn't look too bad when you were just looking at it.
Yeah, so the sheer strength, to some extent, the extent of your vulnerability and fear for your life, right? I'm going to connect with that in just a minute. We live in Decorah, Iowa. It's a pretty steep watershed. In the last, we've lived there 25 years. We've had 3 500-year flood events. So we have precipitation bursts of 6 to 8 to 10 inches somewhere in the watershed. What falls down has to drain through. We're lucky that we have a steep watershed where the water does drain through. The Army Corps of Engineers built a bunch of dikes to protect the city from these, flood events. And actually, what I want to talk about is not so much the one, I think it was not the most recent one, but the one before. That one, we were forced to evacuate our house because the flood came within a foot of the top of the dike, and they were afraid that all that water pressure was going to collapse the dike and flood all of our homes. But what I want to talk about is in the winter, we had a similar big precipitation event in the spring. And that water all gushed down, and meanwhile there was a foot of ice in many parts of the river. Have you ever seen that when a river floods that has ice in it? It's loud, cracking, and those big blocks of ice are capturing trees, moving boulders, In that regard, I remember standing on the dike watching this incredible physical force just move everything out of its way. And that's, I think, what Amos is trying to get at. Somewhere there it is. Let justice roll down like waters. Imagine justice flowing through the world, clearing out everything that impedes justice. For me, that's how I read this particular text. That's the religious significance I associate with it. How about springs? Any stories about springs?
My family, for me, it was from age 11 on. We lived on a tree farm where all long-term growth, and we built a house there. So it was in 1974, and a spring was our source of water.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was just this beautiful place, and we put a little pump in there and stuff to make it be our source of water, which is our house. But I just remember always being really grateful for that spring. And later, many, many, many years later, we were able to dig a well successfully through private reasoning. And so then we didn't use the spring as a resource anymore. So then we were able to kind of restore it back to its
original.
I was glad to see it back. It's beautiful. Yeah. But the water tasted so good.
Yeah, yeah.
So sweet.
Yeah. Pure. Cold.
Yeah.
Yes.
I have a little different take on that. I grew up in southwest Minnesota, farm country.
Yeah.
We used to drive to a spring that was near my hometown, about 14 miles away. A lot of people would get the water because it was so pure and it tasted so good. And it's all the springs that are in that county are closed because of the nitrate pollution. So there's so much pollution there in the groundwater that they had to bring water from the Missouri River to my community that far. I mean, it's across the state of Minnesota, halfway across the state of Southwest, I should say. or they can now drink fresh water. So it sends a real message about what we've been dealing with here in terms of how we deal with that resource around us and
absolutely
ways to. It's not just the farmers, it's the others as well, but we need to have a different ethic about that.
Yeah. I'll come back to that when we talk about baptizing and moving water. Let me move on now. I should just admit this, right? This is the first time I've ever run this session. So I'm not sure I'm doing a good job of managing time. But I definitely have stuff I want us to get to. Moving beyond streams to focus on the flood motif. They are, you know, incredible events. They transform. They're essential to the ecological health of the planet. They distribute nutrients more widely across floodplains, but they can definitely disrupt and even destroy human communities. They can scare the living daylights out of us. Martin Luther, when he was talking about baptism, talked about a flood of grace rather than a flood of wrath in his 1519 sermon on baptism. And I just want to read an excerpt. I think what I'll do is not read Luther so much, but I'll read Ben Stewart's sort of summary of Luther's emphasis here. Ben says, Luther's prayer uses the flood of Noah as its orienting metaphor. The role of humans, the significance of other species, and the survival of life on the planet are all central themes in the Genesis narrative. In the biblical narrative, the flood covers everything. The narrative repeats emphatically, every living creature outside of the ark was drowned. Even the highest mountains were deeply covered. After the flood, just as radically and completely, the new covenant extends out over the whole earth for all humans and all other living creatures, even toward all future creatures. The text reads, I am establishing, God is establishing my covenant with every animal on the earth. Never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. Ben says, in the original biblical narrative out of which the metaphor of flood comes, the radical world-encompassing extent of the flood's power is emphasized. Because Luther describes baptism in terms of the biblical flood, baptism is portrayed as touching, engulfing everything, leaving nothing the same. The extent of the meaning of baptism, says the flood prayer, is literally global. Nothing on earth or in the future stands outside of its reach. I think rather than read another chunk of that, I'm going to move on a little bit here. So these are a couple more summaries that Ben offers about the importance and a way to think about how baptism, using water, hallows the entire planet as the arena of God's activity. The flood of baptism affects the whole planet. The water metaphors urge us to know all water as holy water, that all water is part of a saving flood, and that those who are baptized are swept up in the flood of grace to participate in the care and healing of earth. I'm not sure at any baptism I've ever attended that last point has been emphasized. That those who are baptized are swept up in the flood of grace to participate in the care and healing of earth. Boy, I think if when we have a chance to rework some of our liturgies related to baptism in the ELW or subsequent editions, I hope that kind of rhetoric gets put in there, because I think it speaks volumes. And you know, think about all the people that come to baptisms that aren't normally in church. And for them to hear that this is really what's happening here, is that this person being baptized is being swept up in this flood of grace and thus empowered to engage in care and healing of the earth. Well, Lisa Dayhill, the other person, you might recognize that this is a snippet of the cover art off of this book. It's by an artist, I forget his first name, but it's Swanson, he lives in California. It's a beautiful piece. What was that?
John August Swanson.
I think so, yes. And so here you have John the Baptist baptizing Jesus in the River Jordan, right? Anyway, Lisa Dayhill takes this a little further. And she says, Christians should pursue ecological conversion through literal re-immersion into the wildlife of Earth's hydrologic system. And one way to do that is by restoring the normative practice of Christian baptism into local waters. The early church, she says, like John the Baptist, practiced baptism in the rivers that were available. Living water in Scripture means flowing water. If the practice of all Christian baptism moves normatively outdoors, this forces even the rich in a given area to have skin in the game, to care about the quality of the water that their children and their grandchildren are going to be baptized in. So here are three perspectives that she has about this, and I'd like you to talk about them. She says, how urgently might we and all the Christians of a given watershed take action against the degradation of these waters, which are endangering the vulnerable humans we long to baptize here, or against policies that dump toxic waste in certain zip codes, poisoning children, and leaching these chemicals into drinking water? In other words, if we start baptizing outdoors, do you think people will start caring about these things, about the degradation of the waters and the impact of disposing of toxic waste in our local waterways? How might the Spirit who fills all Earth's baptismal waters, oxygenated and alive, animate our protest against water privatization, pollution, and waste? And then finally, could baptism into real waters break the catastrophic spell of otherworldliness? I talked about this on the first day, this notion that Christianity is heaven-focused, and that we need to get out of our otherly worldliness and focus on the world that God has created. Could baptism into real waters break that catastrophic spell? Could it enact viscerally at last what being Christian means today, our shared physical and spiritual participation in the threats and aliveness of God in the life of the world itself? These are Lisa's points. This is her writing. I'm just chopping it out and throwing it on a slide. Talk about one of those, talk about all three of those, but take a few minutes just to, and you know, my guess is you'll have other thoughts about baptizing outdoors in local waters, and if you want to talk about that, that's fine too. But talk about this idea, because I think it's provocative and could be transformative. Take another minute. Okay, I hate to cut your conversation short, but it's, unless you're talking about what's on the menu for dinner, it seems like you're engaged with these questions. So what do you think? We can talk about any of these. We can talk about all of them at once. What do you think about Lisa's idea that we baptize and do affirmations of baptism outdoors? Yeah.
This is a great subject. We live on the beach in Oregon and deal with a lot of water. Flood events, we live on a creek, we have springs, all these things are great ideas. We love the thought of folks, congregations using water sources to baptize. But we feel like it would be hard to pull off in terms of getting community involvement and keeping the waters clean. Mm. Common bad environmental practices there with a lot of logging and farming. So it's a great, awesome idea. We feel like it would get little traction where you live.
It would get little traction where you live. And say again where you live?
In Tillamook County.
Tillamook County?
Tillamook County.
Is that here in the state of Washington?
Oregon.
I'm sorry. Pick one of the 99 counties in Iowa. I'd probably figure it out. Okay, so it sounds like a good idea. You would support it. But you don't think it'll get much traction because, in fact, many of the waterways are polluted?
I think they were mistreated.
Mistreated.
It would be a real challenge to suggest to the people that use our hills to log, private and state, to amend their practices.
Yeah, right. And that's what Lisa's arguing.
Great way to get it going.
Yeah.
A great thing to pitch into the conversation.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Thank you. Let's find another voice here that I haven't heard from yet, and then I'll come back to you. Someone else. How about in the peanut gallery?
Chuck mentioned that there's been some conversation about how interesting it would have been if we had formed political boundaries around the watersheds.
Mm-hmm.
And keep in mind that that actually probably will happen in the coming years as water becomes a political issue.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the church doesn't need to worry about this. The politicians will figure it out.
Well,
we can just keep using our teacups and
start with the church.
Okay. The church, by baptizing outdoors, ignites the interest of the congregation, and the congregation puts the pressure on the politicians to pay attention to the watershed. Okay, great. Sorry, I didn't. Chuck wasn't here to defend himself, so I just, you know. How about the rest of you? What do you think? What were you saying in your small groups? Yeah.
I was sharing that the one example that springs to mind of somebody having been baptized in a flowing stream of some sort were pictures that I saw on Facebook of my cousin's elementary-age children being baptized. But the irony is that they were part of a church that would not have concern for anything pertaining to creation.
And so let alone politics.
There's a cognitive dissonance there, and perhaps just a good fortune of being able to access a spot where presumably it wasn't too nasty to do that. And so how do we prevent people from siloing themselves off from seeing waters as holistic, as in fact, of course, they are.
Yeah.
And getting away from the idea that if I've got access to a situation, I don't necessarily need to worry about the child in the urban part of the county who would be baptized in the Willamette River that runs through Portland, which I was saying kind of grosses me out as a thought at the moment. Mm-hmm. Dealing with that cognitive dissonance that may exist in Christian society is an interesting question.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Floyd, is that?
I don't know exactly how to say this, but I have trouble with this because I think the number of baptisms
would decline.
In our small congregation.
Yeah.
And I feel that this reaching into our drinking water is more important, and that we have to, as Christians, act by using politics, whatever, to get the waters clean. And what additional force is going to be done by stressing baptism in the waters?
Mm-hmm.
I feel it's minor.
Okay, so from your perspective, this might lead fewer families to want to have their child baptized if the only way you can have it baptized is immersed in the local waterway. And secondly, there are other ways to address the pollution of our waterways and to alert citizens about these concerns besides this approach. But
as I've listened to people, when Barb and I were talking, I was kind of saying that I think this would be awesome. I say go for it, and I think it would be fantastic. But with knowing that that also means, first things that popped into my mind, just in terms of like our congregation, if we were going to start doing baptisms outside, we live in Seattle, so it'd be Puget Sound probably or some water is accessibility for congregational members, like some of the people who might have. Hard to get around, like getting there, and but then I, for me, that wouldn't be enough to stop trying to do this.
Mm-hmm.
I think anytime you change something, there's going to be barriers.
Mm-hmm.
You just doesn't mean you shouldn't try to do it and do it.
How many Lutherans does it take to change a light bulb? takes 10, 1 to change the light bulb, and 9 to talk about how much they like the old one.
Yes, yes, there you go. And then the other part of it was just the, wait, hold on. Wait,
sorry.
No, that's okay.
I can see baptizing outdoors, but I'm not sure I can see using outdoor water from natural sources in Seattle or around Seattle. So possibly this could be introduced by using water from the tap, taken outdoors.
Mm.
But here again, 9 months of the year in Seattle, it's rainy and coldy.
Yeah, cold.
Rainy and cold.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that would work or not.
Yeah, I think Lisa's argument is that doing it this way reminds us that we are part of nature, and to be cold is part of this, and that it makes us more hyper aware of the natural world around us. I'm just trying to, give the kind of arguments that I think she would give. Anybody have a different, have another perspective, Joyce? Is it Joyce? Jana, I keep getting it wrong.
So it just struck me, as I also live in Seattle, just thinking about the first bullet here, that Seattle is already hyper-ecocentric.
Yeah.
And the west side of the Cascade Mountains, i.e. Seattle, is also very unchurched.
Mm.
Super high population where people don't go to church.
Yeah.
Compared to like every other state.
Yeah.
So I wonder if to accomplish the first bullet of cleaner water,
yeah,
is it okay to have that accomplished not through a Christian perspective, but just from the big environmental perspective? Because in our area, it's all very active, moving that way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Or would it attract some unchurched people because here's a group taking it very seriously? I mean, that's a chicken and an egg.
Yeah, so I'm wondering how the Christian voice would be heard in this community,
mm-hmm,
this region, where we already have a fairly strong, mm-hmm, environmental focus.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah.
Save the salmon.
Yeah. Right.
The whole ecosystem thing is,
yep,
is very prevalent, and it just struck me that is the
preaching to the choir in that case.
A little bit, or so what is the point of the first bullet? Is it the clean water? Is it the baptism?
On the other hand, if you're from Southwest Minnesota, maybe it's a different story. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but do you want to comment about that?
Yeah, it is. And just to backtrack what you said about Seattle and its ethic for clean water environmentally, Minnesota is very similar. And we passed the Clean Water,
mm-hmm,
Amendment a number of years ago that people in the state agreed to pay more taxes for that. And yet, as we look at it, where we are now, things have not improved enough. And we've got one particular party that's looking at ending that amendment.
Mm-hmm.
When we've been making progress, but it's been slow, and there have been stalwarts against that. So I don't know where that stands. It's scary to me. So things can change pretty quickly,
mm-hmm,
in that whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
But in Southwest Minnesota, where I grew up, it would be, I think there'd be some pushback against something like this as well. But I think I would love to see that introduced as a way that a church might push this forward and say, we're going to do this, even outdoors in the church. You bring water in from the Rock River that's very polluted up against the tap water and kind of say, how can we improve this?
which vessel would you like to be immersed in?
Right.
Anyway, yeah, it could be quite a conscientizing moment there. Yeah, yeah. Well, anyway, we're not here to answer these questions. We're here to talk about them. Yep.
Well, I think maybe if these baptisms occurred less frequently. Maybe you could limit them to like 4 or 6 times a year.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you could include other parishes, other denominations, and just have like a community
mm-hmm.
baptism almost. And mm-hmm. Then I could see it as being, and then maybe more liturgy around it too than just the baptism. Maybe you could have an entire service or mass or something.
Service or mass around it. Yeah, a really interesting idea there about making this an ecumenical experience and not just one church or one baptism, but several baptisms from different congregations in a community. Yeah, that would be amazing. John, you're looking right at me really hard.
I was just thinking that it's a way to start that Reformation process,
mm-hmm.
to tap into a traditional practice in the church and make that connection and plant that seed to start moving
mm-hmm.
in that direction, be more aware of it,
mm-hmm.
more conscious, at least in the church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Lisa's a little straight in here, you know. She says, let's move them all outside. Right? There's no point going on backwards, but that's what she says. Let's do them all. That not only baptisms, but affirmation, confirmation services. Hold them at the river. Hold them at the creek. Well, I guess I kind of am where you are, John. I think it's not like anyone. I have a magic wand. This is going to happen everywhere. But I think where it does happen, I can't quite see the harm, and I can see a serious upside to it. I agree that in some communities like Seattle, where it's so environmentally conscious, it may not be the sort of ignition of conscience about care for creation may not be needed. But it does testify. And then she would say, well, what about this business about being outdoors and being baptized into the earth's waters for you? I mean, for the person who's being baptized, how might that transform you, especially if you're getting baptized or affirming your baptism later in your life? We probably don't have enough time to do justice to the third one, streams, floods, and springs. Ben Stewart says, springs have long been symbols of God's goodness that sustain and refresh us. This is a picture of a famous spring in my town. And Karen and I live in Decorah. What's that? Yeah, it's a beautiful place. And actually where we live, there are a lot of cold water, a lot of springs that provide cold water for trout populations. So there are a lot of anglers that come to Winnipeg and Allamakee County, and these springs are not only sources of you know water for the Upper Iowa River, but they're sources for these wonderful fish. Anyway, Ben in his article says the Reformation guided the church back to forgotten or neglected springs of grace, and here's the list that he comes up with, especially the incarnate crucified and risen Christ, Sunday gathering around both word and sacrament, forgiveness of sins as opposed to works righteousness and justification by grace through faith, the fact that all of us have a vocation, not only the priest, the importance and goodness of the arts, especially music, that this is a spring of grace in our tradition, and then the gift of mutually supportive and just human relationships with a special concern for those who are most vulnerable. Anyway, in his essay, these are the arguments he's making that the Reformation served as a kind of rediscovering these forgotten or neglected springs. And he goes on to say that he thinks we need to realize that creation itself is a spring, which when we're up here, if you know, you're hiking out to Heart Lake or Holden Lake, it's pretty hard to not perhaps have that impression, that earth itself is a continually flowing spring-like font of God's grace. But then he has this interesting, this is a story he heard from the president of Philadelphia Lutheran Seminary, and the president was talking about how on old farms you had springs and spring houses. Karen, didn't your farm in West Virginia have a spring house? Now here it looks like the spring's rushing by, but I think in your farm the spring was inside that shed, right? And it functioned as a means of refrigeration, didn't it? Yeah. Well, anyway, so Ben says, you know, old farms often had these spring houses. Does this ring a bell with any of the rest of you? Have you have any experience of this? Okay, sorry. Then this is kind of totally whatever. But he says, you know, farmers had to clear out that spring so it could flow better and flow more cleanly, and that our congregations may need to clear out the spring. And what might that entail in your congregation or community? In what way is the spring of life-giving gospel being impeded or polluted or thwarted? Ben doesn't answer that question, but I find it to be a really provocative one to think about, and for us to think about our congregations or our communities as fonts of grace, as fonts of life-giving, in this case, water, but you know, as a motif, that our congregations be life-giving, are there things we need to do to clear out a way so that can happen? Any brilliant thoughts in that regard? Or not so brilliant? I suppose we could get into that pastor's got to go. My God, he preaches for half an hour. Does this conjure up anything in you in terms of, does this make any sense to you? Yeah.
Well, not necessarily related to water, but in our congregation we do in September, October, and during Lent, we call a day of caring where we invite especially children and the high school kids that are part of the parish. And they do one thing from 9 to 12. They get houses to clean or yards to clean.
Okay.
And the Catholic Community Service provides the homes for the, mm-hmm. they are the resource center, we'll mm-hmm. say as ever. And we draw, it depends when we first start out, we have probably close to 100 people out. If now after it's gotten to be a useful idea, it drops down. But it could be a stream that they be cleared out. On a county-wise basis, there's a day of caring in September, and it could be water as well as everything, and it flows through the whole county. And there are about 1,000 volunteers.
Yeah, yeah. Excellent. That's a great, great story, great example. Karen?
Well, when I talk to students today, at Luther anyway, the reason they don't go to church is that the church doesn't seem relevant to the most important issues facing the world. And I think sometimes our pastor is too scared to say anything that might cross the line politically. And I understand that. You want everyone to feel welcome. But at what point is it just milquetoast and not being prophetic or pushing us to engage? And I think young people might come back if it felt like the church was really addressing some of this stuff. I mean, until today, I had no idea that Luther was more creation-centric. How have we lost that in the Lutheran church? We don't hear that. It seems like it's still pretty heaven-centric.
Along those lines, in our church we do a season of creation each spring. It has been sometimes fall, sometimes spring, and it was 4 Sundays this year. It was just 3, but where we do have a focus on, I think we have a focus all the time, actually, in our church. I think we're pretty, and Eric Lubaiska, he's my husband, he's pastor, but I think he is not afraid to speak out at all. I mean, he feels like politics, I mean, Jesus was really political, you know, like, And so I think that keeps our church, that along with the congregation, everything is really vibrant and alive. And this great focus of creation, you know, changes from year to year. This year we focused on aviation, birds. It was beautiful, thought-provoking. And so sometimes, like, you know, 4 Sundays of Earth, Sea, Sky, whatever. So it's really, but...
Have you lost numbers? Because
no, although... creation season, there are, I know, just like a couple people that don't come on for those like 3 or 4 Sundays, and
have to admit, I think that's kind of ridiculous, but just to not come, it's like, because it's not completely out of the, no, I mean, it's not ridiculous, it's their comfort zone, it's not what it, but I think, no, we haven't lost members. I think people think it's funny, for the most part.
We're just a little bit past five, and I know some of your stomachs are rumbling. I'm gonna just skip these slides just to remind you that the session tomorrow is on Bonhoeffer, the Church, and the Climate Question. Bonhoeffer wrote an essay called "The Church and the Jewish Question" in 1933, and I'm gonna take the three arguments three points he made there in terms of how the church should interact with the state, and explore how they might pertain to the issue of climate change, and focus on the third step, which is the most controversial in Bonhoeffer's essay, which is to put a spoke in the wheel, put a monkey wrench into the works of the state. I'm going to focus there, interpret that as civil disobedience. So that's the focus for tomorrow. If these two sessions have whetted your interest at all in this, the contents of this book, there are copies for sale in the bookstore. And what doesn't sell, I have to cart home. So if you think your pastor at home would enjoy reading it or whatever, you know, please shell out $20 and take it home with you. But anyway, thanks very much for coming, and I hope you found this a useful and interesting time.